Transformation is difficult in anything, and that's true for employees, and it's true for riders or just people living in the area, right? People get used to it, they're happy. I mean, unless there's a big problem, like where they're really missing something, generally it works. And so part of this change management is you've got to figure out how you can push things aggressively. So you want, while at the same time, because again, we talk about people being the greatest strength or the greatest weakness. If you get it wrong, you may have the great technology. I think Uber found this, and some of the micro transit, you know, they've been calibrating, and there's still a lot of controversy around that, but you know, how they go into cities and how they adapted, and it worked for them in some areas, and in other cities it didn't, and sometimes they were shut out, and this is more true of the scooters. And so I think there's, you know, what I found on especially things like micro transit is it can be really granular in terms of how they adapt. So, you know, it's, you've got to figure out how it actually practically integrates well. It's not just throwing it in there. And so that's an example where fundamentally it comes back to the basic principles of engaging with people, working with them, change management, both for staff and riders. And that's a people thing, right? And people want to feel included and part of the journey. And so I think like a lot of these things where we've probably as an industry made mistakes at sometimes is around how you communicate, how you bring in this change. And because otherwise you do face a backlog.
Welcome to the Mobility Innovators Podcast.
Hello everyone. Welcome to another episode of Mobility Innovators Podcast. I'm your host, Jaspal Singh. Mobility Innovator Podcast invite key innovators in the transportation and logistics sector to share their experience and future forecasts. In this episode, we'll be discussing the role of mobility and public transportation to shape up the city. Our today guest has spent more than 20 years in senior role in North America, Africa, and Middle East. Currently, he's the Infrastructure and Transportation Project Management Lead at HDR Middle East. Prior to this, he was the head of land mobility and road transportation at NEOM, a new city in Saudi Arabia. He served as general manager at Saudi Public Transport Company, SEPCO, from 2018 to 2021. He also spent 7 years with Toronto Transit Commission from 2003 to 2010, including 5 years as a commissioner and chair of TTC. I'm so happy to welcome Adam Gambordi, Infrastructure and Transportation Project Management Lead at HDR Middle East. Now it's time to listen and learn. Hey, hello, Adam. So good to have a fellow Canadian on this podcast. We were trying to record it and finally we are doing it now.
Yeah, I know we've talked and talked often about lots of transit topics all around the world. And it's good to actually focus in on and have a specific check this time.
No, great. And like I was mentioning to you, when I was researching about your profile, I found it pretty impressive. And in fact, I am also somebody who not ever studied transit or mobility and came into this space and love it. And that's what I found when I was learning about your profile. You did your bachelor in archaeology and anthropology and African study from McGill. And then you were working with the Royal Ontario Museum for quite some time. Eventually, you landed in Sudan for archaeological mission. And there, you took a jump and moved from archaeology to transportation and start working with this company called Khartoum Mawasalat Bus Company in Sudan. I'm very curious why this jump from archaeology to mobility. And I see your journey is pretty impressive so far. So would love to know more about how your journey is so far in transit space.
Well, you know, I grew up at the museum. I say that because I attended classes. They had classes on Saturday. They did things in the summer. And so I, you know, attended classes for a long time there and sort of became one of those kids that was really involved in the museum. And I had a job at the museum. I mean, nothing special. It was a summer job with teaching kids and things and helping clean up. But that really led to a connection through archaeology and being given the opportunity to go on a Royal Ontario Museum mission to Sudan. And I tell the story, I won't bore your listeners now with it, but I think I was their last choice. I mean, at the time I was still a teenager. And I remember asking about going and they were very nice, but said no. And then later came on and I think like 8 or 9 people had to drop off the mission. And so I got the opportunity to go and it was really a fantastic opportunity in Northern Sudan. Of course, the country today has some real serious problems, the civil war. But at the time, no security issues really in the north of Sudan. And they had a great mission excavating at the time a Christian site. But throughout the north, they had a series of excavations. And so that gave me my first chance to do archaeology. But what I liked about archaeology, besides the research, is it involved being with people a lot. And you worked with people. You know, that's when I started learning Arabic. And jumped quickly to the Khartoum opportunity. After I did the first one, I came back to Sudan to learn Arabic and stay in Khartoum. I was with a colleague who was another archaeologist, but they were all about my age going to the University of Khartoum, and it gave me an opportunity. And in Sudan, as you probably know, as in many parts of Africa, and actually Asia and around the world, a lot of the transport sector is informal. So there are, in the case of Sudan or at the time, there was licenses given to a bus operator, but then they're free to ride provide services wherever. But it doesn't quite work out that way. And like, interestingly, Columbia University did a study of these informal transport, and there is a network. And so in Sudan, this company that, it was through a connection, had a series of what they called hafas or minibuses that ran routes. And the routes, well, again, theoretically, they're free, anyone, they've developed into very core routes. And in fact, there's hand signals that they called them a commissioner. I think it comes from an old British term, but they will sit there and they'll call out a location and also give a hand signal because you might not see it. So you then flag down the bus. So they're running. So this company actually, although it wasn't required, ran a series of basically routes that were always the same, pretty much running 20 hours a day, and it gave me an opportunity to sort of be thrown in there and learn bus operations, different than what we would do in North America or perhaps elsewhere around the world, but still actually, fundamentally, the basics were there, right? You have to provide service. You have to be somewhat reliable, right? Or else people are gonna choose something else. And so some of those really basic principles, even though no one sat me down and said, okay, here are the planning principles, here's our operation principles, everybody there working on it knew them, they'd learned them instinctively, and that's how they operated the service. And it was incredibly reliable service. You could get anywhere, and I still, up into the point where the civil war and Corona was, when I was back in Khartoum every year, doing archaeology, seeing friends all through my time at the Toronto Transit Commission in Saudi, the system still works very well, and you would know how to use it just from the hand gestures.
No, that's amazing. I mean, I think you share some very important point. One point which you mentioned is the transit is about people. And any business which is about people is like transit. You know, you touch the life of people. Mm-hmm. And the second point you mentioned is it doesn't matter what kind of a bus you are using or service you're using. It has to be reliable. It has to be fast. And people should reach from point A to point B, because even in Sudan, they have those mini buses or informal transport, but they function very well. And they move people very quickly.
And they have, there's 40,000 operators, or there was at the time. And so, you know, it's a huge service. And 85%, we learned this afterwards, not at the time, because I did some work on a bus rapid transit system for Sudan with the interim government that came in after the revolution. And, we found 85% of all trips were made on public transit. Which is an incredibly high number. Not unusual for other cities, similar to Khartoum, but still compared to North America or Europe.
Yeah, I mean, we always give example of Hong Kong, which is near, saving a very high percentage of public transport mode. But you rightly mentioned some of these cities, we don't consider them, but a lot of people rely on the public transit, and it's important. Now I want to discuss your last adventure, which was in Saudi Arabia, NEOM. Because it's a city which everybody is very excited about, because it's count as a future city of the future, where they are implementing a lot of technology, a lot of work. And you had two crucial roles. You were managing head of mobility, and then you were head of road transportation. So would love to know more about your role. What were you doing in NEOM? And how do you see this whole concept about building this city of future? What is the overall vision of this project? How they want to change the city landscape?
Well, first of all, NEOM is much more than a city. It's 26,000 square kilometers, about the size of Belgium. And so, And what they what it's trying to do is be that part of that transformational part of Saudi Arabia, where it operates under a separate legal code than from the rest of Saudi, easy for business to operate, people to feel comfortable coming from all over the world to do business in the Middle East, close to Europe. Middle East always serves that that split between Asia and Europe and Africa very easy. And NEOM was supposed to is supposed to make it easy, and it's focused. They've made some principles, long-term being sustainable, focused on technology and livability. So, you know, you find this interesting mix of taking new ideas like or trying to try out new concepts, but then also falling back on the basics that you need a city that works for people today. And so what was interesting for me through this journey in transportation is, you know, we started as the mobility people both working with a lot of these challenging areas, like the line, which is the city 170 kilometers long, 200 meters wide, about 500 meters high. And how do you like provide transport? And again, there's no cars in the city and part of the line because there's no place for them. And, you know, we evaluated things like Hyperloop, you know, eVTOLs, which are all these future technologies that may have a role in the future. But today, and even in this, in the NEOM of say 2030, they're still not going to be ready for large scale deployment. Right. Mm-hmm. And so what we ended up falling back on, interestingly, is, you know, some tried and tested modes that have been updated. So high-speed rail, metro, interesting things like for automated metro, although not that new. I guess the first ones go back to the 1970s in France. But they had this concept of how we were going to adapt these traditional modes into a building. And one of the biggest challenges was not horizontal travel, but vertical.
Yeah.
So if you're moving down. And so how do you, and do you really want to go down half a kilometer, get on a metro, travel, you know, 3 kilometers or a short trip, and then up on, up the elevator. So there were a lot of challenges, both with logistics, you have to get food and people's packages to this building. And so a lot of the traditional modes, everything being employed, micro transit, everything, for example, like even we were thinking of like funiculars going up at angular planes, and really this challenge on, hey, taking these traditional modes and adapting them to a new use. But it's not just the line. There was also the interesting thing about NEOM is it had these regions. So I won't go through all of them with you, but, you know, you think about Octagon, which was a port and had a floating city. So one of the fun things was, you know, I've done a lot with LRT. Well, now the question was, they originally thought about, okay, they're all going to be autonomous pods. But if you have almost a like 95% modal share towards public transit, other than walking as a mechanized transport, you can't use mobility like these pods. And as I used to call them, you know, so these pods have four wheels, they're moving around. So they're kind of like either a taxi, or if they're bigger, they're a bus. And at the end of the day, you just can't have, taxis can't provide. I mean, I think we had at one point needing 9,000 people per hour per direction. So we fell back. We went through this whole long arch of all the technology and fell back on an LRT system. And then the fun thing about this was we wanted to put it, they have a floating platform. Well, how do you get LRT? I mean, normally railroad tracks don't like to move up and down with the water. But, you know, I remember talking to my colleagues in Stockholm who had worked on light rail, and they brought up some interesting bridges in the U.S. and Seattle that actually has a floating LRT bridges that uses the same technology as like as they use for buildings for earthquakes. So it can move. I mean, it doesn't move that much, but it has to be able to move. And so just thinking about how we – so taking a relatively – older or, you know, established technology and figuring out how to do it fully with batteries and also on a floating platform. So there were lots of examples like NEOM of that happening where we actually had this opportunity to really rethink some of the traditional modes. And my experience through UITP, for example, I remember very clearly the Trojena, which is the mountain region. Yeah. We had to get people up 2,500. It's where the Asian Winter Games will occur in 2029. So we had to get people from a train station, put them on a bus for an hour and a half. This was the first stop. Put them up on a funicular and then on a gondola. Well, you know, Lyon in France, line C, I think it is a unique Alstom and Staedtler combination train, which goes at 80 kilometer or up to 80 kilometers in a traditional metro setting. Then the old line C had a funicular incorporated. So this train goes up, comes down with a clog wheel, goes up and then can continue in a way. So it was like one of those examples, like where you'd seen something in the past this might be the only one that was very applicable for consideration in a place like Trujillo, where we had to get from a metro station for 60, 70 kilometers up a mountain, and then you want to continue. So there was sort of that interesting meld of totally new and then the very traditional sort of technologies that are employed.
Yeah, it sounds like your time was quite fun at NEO, because having new challenges and going back to the drawing board, experiencing what is other cities around the world are doing and bringing those best example to one place. And I was not aware that NEO is like size of Belgium, which is huge. I mean, Belgium is not a small country, so.
No, but interestingly, the other, and it's just a random statistic, I looked it up, but Belgium has, I think, 116,000 kilometers of roads. We had about 4,500 kilometers. We were going to add some for residential areas. So I think we probably would end up somewhere with a network around 7,000. So, very different profiles, obviously. Yeah. 95% of NEOM is kept in its natural desert state. So, and that's actually where most of the mobility, I call it revolution, came. So yeah, technology can play around, but just by planning the communities, I mean, this is classic urban planning, right? Where you're going to have dense communities where even in 45 degrees, maybe you're using the shadow so you can walk a short distance, right? Cooling, and making sure those communities were connected by public transit. I mean, these are not, the implementation may be radical, the ideas are not. They're very go back over a century. But it was interesting how you take those very traditional notions of urban planning, meld them with a mission to sort of, and a challenging climate, like where summers are 45 degrees, and try to make them work as a comprehensive public transit mode. And then, interestingly, my role shifted initially to drafting the legislation. So NEOM will be an autonomous region. And so it means it'll have its own transportation act or legislation. And then thinking about how you build in issues around autonomous vehicles, how you give the government, in that case, the power to ban certain fuels like fossil fuels when the time is right, and ban or severely limit or put charges or all the legislation that you need in order to reduce or eliminate private car use. And so this whole legislative package was then the next thing. And so that is sort of, it's an interesting where you take the planning, the review of technology, the thinking of that, and having to bring in people who are experts, and then melding it with a legislative framework that supports all that, because one without the other, and this is what we see in North America, where, build these large subdivisions, like, and then somebody comes by and says, well, what about public transit? Well, it's very hard when you've got these, that whole thing, maybe in fact, that's one of the unique inspirations, although other cities like Singapore are well known for, planning the urban transport, linking it with transportation, and lots of other cities too. But that may be, in a sense, from ground zero up, doing it in that way. So that might be one of the unique elements of NEOM.
Oh, that's amazing. And you rightly mentioned about it's like the solution is not these individual ports or small cars. The solution is going back to the basic, these LRT solution or railways or having buses. And now we have bi-articulated buses and bigger buses. So the ultimate solution is going back to the basic, not like we can still innovate, but it doesn't mean the traditional mode will not sustain or survive. I think they have their own role.
Yeah, I mean, railroads are over 200 years old. I mean, obviously, and changed dramatically from the early 19th century. But, the principles are still there. And I suspect, although, I haven't done all my history reading, but I suspect some of the same planning decisions they were making then still apply today. And again, even though they're subsidized, you do want to try to make a most efficient transportation system you can, both for the riders, but also for the government from a budget perspective. So yeah, those two principles, I think, have probably remained the same for a while.
Yeah, I don't know. History repeats itself. So your archaeology and mobility is the best combination. Now, you mentioned a little bit about the line, and line is one of the exciting projects, I would say, in NEOM, or I would say the most advertised or most attractive project in NEOM. You mentioned about Octagon and other project, and I know there are many other things that are happening in NEOM, but line is getting a lot of attention from public because it's very radical, building a city in a line And like you mentioned, it's a 200 meter wide, 500 meter long wall, and then people will be living in that line. Although they now the cutting down the size, earlier they were planning 170 kilometer, like you mentioned, but now I think I read some news which saying they want to reduce the size for time being and then expand it.
Phased.
What do you think about this whole project?
Well, look, it's incredibly ambitious, right? And so this is, and I think in this, you see often in the Middle East, and it's not, it actually is, I think, an interesting trait where the goal has been, you know, you push as hard as you can, even maybe in the back of your mind, if you know that they're somewhat unrealistic targets, what the goal is push as hard as you can, knowing that that way you'll get more than, say, the normal build. And but, you know, being honest, perhaps with yourself, and again, I don't speak to all the decision makers, but, you know, I suspect being somewhat honest because they've been around the block, they've been there for a while, that, you know, you probably won't achieve that. So, yeah. So what they've seen is, you know, they started with a very ambitious target that had a lot of challenges for constructability. Like you just at one point, you know, you would have needed something like 400,000 construction workers working at once. And how do you house them all, feed them all? So, yeah, they pushed off this the timelines for it. But today, I mean, the plan essentially stays the same. It's just the implementation. This is, I mean, this is the story, I think, of every transport or almost everybody's transport or every transport professional's lives is, you know, how to keep projects, you know, being realistic, being honest with the public about, you know, the timeline and budget, but also recognizing that there are unanticipated things that come up. And even the best planned project, the best executed, often runs into various challenges, be supply chain, you know, issues with constructability or something. And NEOM is no different. So, you know, if you show up there today, you'll see a lot of the base infrastructure going in, water, electrical, because there were very few people who lived in this area. So the networks were not designed to deal with a population. I guess their new projections are up to 9 million by 2050. So still years out, but they're building a network, right? It's hard to go back and upgrade things. It's if you can plan for it, that's better. So they're laying all that basic infrastructure that will then allow the support for future development.
Yeah, and you rightly mentioned, you always need to dream big. If you start dreaming small, then there is no ambition. You have to dream big and then try to reach for it. And there will be some failure, there will be some delay, but ultimately the goal is to reach there. In fact, I visited the new city, Nusantara, in Indonesia, where they are building a new capital city. And it's look kind of quite ambitious project, but slowly, bit by bit, they are building it. And let's see how things will be in next 30, 40 years.
Exactly. To go. They've had some delays too, but like, I think that's, I mean, sadly, or, you know, just being realistic, almost every project suffers delays. And maybe it calls on us as transport professionals to be a little bit more realistic, or at least, you know, better position people for the reality of the fact that, you know, 9 out of 10 or something, there will be some delays.
There will be some delay. Now, you work in Middle East for quite some time, and you spend a lot of time, you mentioned, in Sudan, as well as in Saudi Arabia. You were general manager for SEPCO, which is one of the largest bus operators there. And a lot of people question, like, Middle East is earlier considered as the oil countries, so they were exporting oil. Oil is very cheap. Everybody has a car. But there is a lot of movement happening in public transport. So how do you see the public transport and mobility space is changing in the region? In terms of the development, a lot of cities are adopting. Like Dubai is the biggest example. Now Dubai has good metro system buses, and they are expanding it. And Saudi is building ambitious project in Riyadh and all. So how do you see the landscape change? And also, how do you see the technology is playing a role? Because when you visit these cities now, you see they are investing a lot in technology. So in next 1-2 decades, what can people expect?
Well, I think, you know, the region is changing very quickly, and it's growing. I think the region, and, you know, we're speaking about a number of countries, so it's hard to generalize, but most of them sort of understand that there is a future at some point with less reliance on oil and gas. And, you know, whether that's 20 years, which might be ambitious, whether it's 50 years, which might be a little bit of unambitious, but, you know, somewhere in that range, they recognize that this, and Dubai is a classic example. I mean, Dubai has almost no petroleum revenue.
Yeah.
As that emirate. Now, the Emirates, the other ones have more revenues from oil and gas, but you know, they started early. And I think a lot of cities are trying to make that push. So they've seen the need to use, they've got a decent revenue stream now. It's an opportunity to invest, and public transit is only one. I mean, they're trying to diversify economies, but transportation is one of the key things. And of course, as we know, when you have a small city, sure, everyone pretty much can drive. Maybe you have taxis or some very small public transit generally kind of works. As you approach cities like Riyadh, which is now coming on 9 million people, you know, even if you have no other concerns about environment or you don't really care about anything else, just practically, you just can't build enough expressways. And I know in Toronto, we used to say the Yonge Line, which is the busiest metro line we have in Toronto, replaces something like 28 lanes of highway. So, you know, even if, again, you don't care, you're just going to build, you could, and of course, that's 28 lanes going, and when you have 20, so you'd have a 56 lane highway. And of course, road ops will tell you that will never work. And then you have to park all the cars anyway. So, you know, so I think cities like Riyadh, which have embarked and are about to open the single largest build in public transit in the world. So I think they issued a contract for over $23 billion to build, I think it's somewhere around 86 stations, like 170 kilometers. Plus, my numbers are going to be plus or minus a few there.
Yeah.
But like, it's big. And yet, you know, just using that as one example, Riyadh is a region of 3,500 square kilometers. So it's like sort of Mexico City. You know, Mexico City has the second largest metro in North America next to New York. And it's, you know, it's got some good capacity. It still only services one third of the metropolitan area. So Riyadh, again, BRT, they need to think about it. And other cities. So, you know, obviously Doha had the World Cup that they had to get a metro up and running in a system. Yeah. Dubai, we talked about, you know, Bahrain, Kuwait both have plans. Cairo, you know, New Cairo, and Cairo itself has a metro. Like all of these cities, and things like Amman in Jordan, where they have a BRT, right? Being realistic, I think they're realizing that for both practical reasons and other objectives, maybe environmental and city building, that they need to develop public transit. So a lot of money is going in there. Now, look, they have it's like places in North America and Europe that designed it for the car, transforming them is very difficult. And so hence, I think places like NEOM, where they say, well, look, what if we can start fresh? You know, anything's happened, put everything that would have happened in the past, and it's a lot easier. But despite that, all of these cities are investing heavily in public transit. They, to be honest, I think everyone would acknowledge they have a long way to go, right? And then what Dubai learned is you can't just build public transit. You have to come back. And I was at UITP in Dubai over 12 or 13 years ago when they were opening it. And I remember trying to get to the metro stop just to use it to get to the UITP Congress. And I had to climb over a fence and it was hot. And to be honest with you, I took taxis the rest of the time. But then when you, over the last couple of years, when you go back to Dubai, you see it very differently, right? And they invested heavily in pedestrianism and walkability. And so I think that's also the next revolution on transport in the region. Sure, you put in the big infrastructure, and now you have to come back and do some of those retrofits, if you will, to make it practical to actually use.
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of people don't believe, but I was there in Dubai last couple of months back, and it's a walkable city now. The weather is a problem. Afternoon, yeah, you cannot walk. Right. But if the climate is good, especially during winter time, it's everybody's on the road. The people sit and people walk. And like you mentioned, they are focusing now on pedestrianization, walking, last mile connectivity. E-scooters are heavily used there. Bicycles are used. Same Riyadh is looking to do. I think the challenge is, a lot of people tell me, oh, it's very hot. But I said, okay, Toronto is very cold to walk, but still people walk. So it doesn't make any difference.
No, you see this in a lot of cities. I mean, where Khartoum being a good example, I mean, Khartoum hits 45 degrees in the summer and you still have 85% modal sweat. Now that's predominantly, frankly, economic. Reality. But, you know, those basic fundamentals, I mean, if you put it in place, and again, maybe it's shade, right? That's, you know, things like really basic concepts. You know, don't make it perfectly comfortable. 45 degrees is still warm in the shade, let's be frank. But it does, if you're getting on an air-conditioned vehicle, you know, you have a stop that's close to you, you can probably manage it. And so that's why being just realistic and practical about it, you know, it's interesting to watch these evolve in the region.
Yeah, and you don't need to use one mode 100% of time. And that's what we tell people. Don't use car 100% of time. So similarly, you don't need to take train 100% of time, but it's always good to mix use. And like you mentioned, some of these cities are becoming so big, it's impossible. I mean, to travel by car in this city, you cannot have 28 lane. Now, you are Canadian by birth and by heart. So that's a first place important to you. And I think Khartoum was the launching pad for you in mobility, but ETC was the scale up or I would say, which helped you to really grow up in mobility. And you were at TTC for 7 years as a senior position, also the chair of TTC. What were some of the biggest challenges you faced when you were the chair of TTC, and what were your learning when you worked there? Because like I said, TTC actually really helped to scale up your knowledge and build your profile in mobility.
Look, I mean, I became the chair and head of the Toronto Transit Commission, which is the multimodal operator in Toronto, operating the metro, trams and streetcars and buses, as well as the adaptive transit for people with mobility challenges. In 2003, I remember at the time, there, you know, it suffered from a lot of the challenges that I think a lot of transit agencies go through. Period. Depends. You know, they go up and down. And one was, there was underinvestment in the state of good repair. There was, I think, both an underinvestment in service, but also an attitude, right? Because you had to deliver good service. You have to have, you know, obviously buses. You have to have some of those, the core elements, but you also have to have the right attitude of employees in terms of how you deliver service, because you can deliver it well with buses or you can deliver it poorly. I mean, it's easy, a little easier with metro and things where you have your dedicated right of way, but the whole concept, and I think the agency at the time had been beset with budget cuts, you know, and then sort of hunkered down. And part of this was the attitudinal shift around being able to do things. And it didn't always mean just huge investments, right? Everybody likes to talk about new subway lines, new metro lines, LRT, but at the heart of it is some of the basic fundamentals, right? Getting bus service working. At the heart of it, no matter in Toronto's case, and you know, other cities are different with bigger metro networks, but Toronto is unique in this, that 70% of the surface transit riders at the time transferred to one of the core metro lines. So without going into tons of details, basically Toronto uses a core network of these metro lines that then are fed by buses. And these buses, at the time, some of these would carry 30, 40,000 people a day. And in fact, one of the tram lines maxed out somewhere a number of years ago before COVID and at over 80,000 people, the King Streetcar. So these are, you know, these are workhorses. There's and they're feeding the metro line. So you get very high peak capacity. So on the Yonge line at the time, you would be looking at over 30,000 people per hour per direction in the peak hour. So, you know, you had this network, but, you know, it was tired. It had I think, morale issues. And so partly was taking it, looking for those big investments. So that isn't, you know, you can't take credit for that as a transit professional, other than making the case and pushing for and communicating, and governments coming to the table with more money. And so, you know, at the TTC, that was a lot of what was the focus on, you know, introducing at the time, and you know, this was years ago, next vehicle information, customer facing elements like that, that could be done, while at the same time renewing the fleet. New streetcars were bought, new metro cars ordered, updating the buses to being the largest at the time hybrid fleet, I think, in North America, and then transitioning to the electric, and then keeping going. And we also, of course, tried to change the shift from metro only, of course, metro has its role, to light rail, and really on the argument that not only could you build 5 or 6 times as much light rail for every dollar that you had, because it's cheaper, but also in certain communities, and a lot of Toronto has a dense urban core and then a suburban area, you can actually get the type of development, because you probably don't want to build, or neighborhoods don't always want 50-story towers along the road, but you know, 8 to 10 stories with a good urban light rail system work. So there was the network of light rail that was begun and is under construction today. again, beset with some delays in construction. But, you know, that transformed, I think, some of the thinking in the regions, and neighboring municipalities like Mississauga, for example, also adopted and further afield. So I think those were the sort of the focuses of my time at the Toronto Transit Commission.
I'm curious how old you were at that time when you took over the chair position.
So I was appointed at 26 to the TTC, and I think if my math going on the years, I think I would have become chair and head of the TTC at 28. It was a very good learning example on a professional. I mean, I've taken a lot of lessons from like 360 reviews because you know, your management teams were a good 20 to 30 years older than me. And so, you know, there was a lot of that figuring out both the transit stuff, but also how to lead at the time a 14,000 person organization and, you know, deal with all the challenges that come up every day on public transit, which is, I guess, will be recognizable to any transit professional around the world.
No, that's impressive. Like I said, the more I learn about you, the more I feel really inspiration story and quite inspiring, I would say, journey so far. In terms of now you're working globally, you are not, I mean, you're based in Saudi Arabia, but you're seeing the system around the world. And one of the key challenge, in fact, what you mentioned people were facing in 2003 is also they're facing now. The ridership is a little lower. The cost is rising. State of good repair is a challenge. You need to invest money. You want to expand the system, but at the same time, you need to maintain what you want to do. The morale is a little bit down because of, you know, when the things are not going well, you doesn't feel happy. So it's the same story now. Again, I think every transit agency is facing some kind of a challenge. What kind of a challenge you want to share with transit agencies to navigate this time period? Because like you said, there is always a boom and bust period. So I'm pretty sure there will be a boom period soon. But during this bust period, what kind of a lesson you want to share? Because you went through that phase earlier.
I mean, I might challenge your question a little bit in the sense that, you know, thinking around the world, there are large places around the world which are doing heavy investment in transit. So you think of China, right, which continues to invest massively. And you know, I visited Beijing and Shanghai years ago, but I know like there's over 100 cities in China with over 1 million people. And so, you know, in most of them, I can say all of them have a public transit. I mean, they've move towards the electrification of their networks, but also metro. And so you think of, and you mentioned the new city in Indonesia, you know, Cairo's building new capitals. There's investments, you know, all around the world. So I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, I'm, of course, traditionally been focused in North America. The Middle East has this boom on. In fact, I mean, percentage-wise, I think transit ridership is going through the roof. I mean, it's a mathematical issue, though. You have a very small base, so any growth. But no, I mean, for some of the longer-term networks, right, the ones that have been around for, say, 100 years in Europe, North America, and elsewhere, there is this challenge, right, where you have these, at the same time, major shifts in how people live, right? Yeah. I mean, this is, I think, you know, as in these legacy cities, I don't think we fully adapted to the fact that, yeah, there's still a rush hour, but, you know, whereas before we would pull off a lot of service in a place like Toronto, right? You have people working 4-hour shifts in the morning, in some cases, and 4-hour, a split shift, as we called them, because we needed we had two peaks. The afternoon peak was a little less, but still, those still exist. I mean, you can still see the blips, but you also have this ongoing ridership. And interestingly, weekend, which for us used to be, as we counted, sort of 2 days were worth 1 day in terms of, you know, the numbers. Now that's very different. And so, you know, but yet, I think, and again, we're generalizing across large numbers of transit agencies. For the most part, they're still focused on the same sort of service delivery and mentality. So I think, like, part of the challenges are here is, like, how does this adapt to the new realities? And, you know, it's still, we're a few years out from the pandemic. You know, we'll see how trends, you know, come and go. But I think the focus has to get back on really thinking about where the riders are, how the systems need to change. And which could be, I mean, you're always constrained by your peak hour. So if you have a smaller peak hour, but greater ridership spread out, in some ways, that's the perfect scenario, right? So there may be some real opportunities there. But I also think it's time, like, transit agencies have to adapt and you know, we talk things like AI, thinking about how you use them. You know, I remember in Khartoum, we were doing some also work with the national railways and just, you know, learning the ability of between the use of drones, AI, being able to assess infrastructure and using it for bridges too, right? Where you the cameras, the AI, not perfect yet, but is allowing you to what would have taken us, I think in that case, it was 5,000 kilometers of rail, you know, being able to do it in about a month. And most of the delays of that month, which will change, were on the computer running. Like, so it collects all the data, and it's such a massive program, it literally has to run for 3 weeks of computational time. So that obviously will change as computers continue to develop. So all of this, you know, we're always struggling, and probably this is true in other industries, I don't know, but where you're trying to keep up and with everything that's going on. And I think probably in public transit, we need to do a better job of really embracing, testing some of this change. Again, it's going back to, you have the same fundamental modes, but in a major way of updating it. And that's, I think, the challenge that's going. And then, but you know, and it comes back to it, and I don't really care, you know, how, whether it's an autonomous vehicle, whether it's an eVTOL or the flying vehicle, they're still going to come back to reliability, predictability, right, and travel time and comfort to a greater extent, and then cost. I mean, all those things in that order generally are what's defined transportation for the last couple hundred years, and I suspect will going forward, regardless of whether it, how it looks.
Yeah, no, I think your point is very important, is like the travel behavior is changing and we need to adapt to that new change rather than just doing what we were doing the last 20, 40 years. And weekends are changing. People are more out because you don't go out during the day. Although a lot of offices are now calling employee to back to their office, back in person, but still we will never have 100%. So in fact, a lot of cities say that riders are back, but not the ridership. So it means the people who were using transit are back, but they are not using the transit the same way. So they have changed the style they are using. And your point about, or we should not get, have this misconception that buying more buses or beautiful buses or electric buses will bring ridership. The ridership will come by reliability, comfort, and punctuality. And like you mentioned, more connectivity. So that's the main.
But, you know, I'm interested, like, I'll give you one example on bus technology. If you go back, and I know because I extended bus 1982 GM buses back in 2008, and they were already, you know, well over 30 years old, and we extended them for a few years. But part of the issue is if you took a bus from the 1970s and the cost escalated at inflation, you know, that is now half the cost of a current bus. And partly that's because different commodities raised at different rates. But a lot of it is that bus from 1982 had no GPS, had no cameras, wasn't air conditioned, didn't have the automatic braking and some of the new autonomous level 4 that's beginning to introduce, had a much dirtier engine system. And so, you know, so it's interesting on those things. So we do find that things like your bus costs, right? Again, not obviously inflation, but they go well above that. Now, having said that, the service a bus today offers you, right, is much better than the service. And some of them now have Wi-Fi on board, but all of those things, you know, cost money. And it's probably another way for the industry, you know, as autonomous vehicles come, as you know, 85 or 90% of a budget is labor. So you could, if you eliminated drivers, but you know, my experience from these things is that it then shifts. So that bus, that even if it doesn't have a driver, now it needs a Wi-Fi technician, right? It's got to have a technician, like all those different ones. It now no longer has someone carrying cash to empty it because it's a tap, but now you have IT
people to manage it.
They're making more than the people who were carrying the cash out of the vehicle in the old days. So I don't know. Like, it's, you know, these are all big, every industry does this, like, you know, labor force projections. My gut tells me is that you're going to have similar numbers of people, but they're going to, but your service, what you come to expect, will actually be higher than, again, what you would have expected either today or going back. So there are a lot of these changes in the industry. And of course, we have to adapt to them because you have this technician or this driver. Well, now you need a computer technician. And so they may be the same person, maybe they're retrainable, but they are a very different profile. So that, you know, it's going to, you may end up with the same number of employees, but I suspect the profile will be very different.
Yeah, no, that's what I experienced. So in China, there are a lot of cities now that have this autonomous vehicle, and there was no driver. And I said, like, how they monitor. So they have people in the control center. So one person monitor 4 to 5 vehicles. So, okay, you don't have a one dedicated to one, but then you have 3 shifts, and then you have technician, you have people who are taking care of, like you mentioned, technology, cybersecurity, GPS. So there are different kind of profile you have, but the number is same.
And for example, for your propulsion, right? So when you're moving it on gas or diesel, like, you've got a bunch of workers extracting it, shipping you the diesel. Well, now you may be even producing some of that power locally.
Yeah.
Right. But you have the technicians on the solar panels, or, you know, the battery retrofits when they have to come in, all those different things. And so this is why this is interesting on how the industry will transition again. Mm-hmm. New people, same people retrained, but that will be, I think, a fundamental shift.
Yeah, we will see. We will see a lot of shift in the society in coming year. One topic I want to discuss with you, and again, it's want to take some knowledge from your experience. So one of the biggest challenge now Canadian cities are facing is housing. And there is a lot of issue with the housing. And Toronto is lucky in that sense, because they were early to develop TOD, mixed development, both residential and commercial. So people are living in the city, whereas in US, most of the downtowns are commercial. So now it's empty. And at the same time, they are facing this housing challenge. So how do you think that this urban development in Toronto help TTC, or TTC help to do the urban development in Toronto? So how they help each other, the transit and urban development? And what are your thoughts about the future of transit-oriented development, like how cities should rethink about it?
You know, one thing we didn't mention is I worked in New York City for the city of New York as LRT and streetcars. And what was always interesting in the U.S. context is they talk a lot about transit-oriented development. Now, that happens a little bit, that conversation in Europe and Asia and Canada, but oftentimes we never really, to be honest with you, used the term transit-oriented development. It was just sort of like part of how the city had developed. Now, that's oversimplification. There are large parts of the suburban area which are very traditional suburban areas. But if you think in the downtown core, where, you know, they built the street, the city took over the Toronto Transit Commission in 1921 in order to provide better service. And one of the first things they did is redid the streetcar lines, get them operating, new fleet, all that. But the city really, if you actually look at how the city developed, it did develop along streetcar lines in the early or the late 19th century, early 20th century. And then that picked up with the subway lines, which essentially followed the two busiest streetcar lines in Toronto. Again, oversimplifying it a little bit here. And then when you look at the satellite, and you could do this for some of the early aerial photos from the 20s all the way up today, I mean, basically a lot of the development, the higher density development followed these core lines. Now, not perfectly, and there's lots of parts where, unfortunately, new subway construction didn't provide high density that they're hoping for, and there's lots of potential to go back and retrofit, but there really was that focus. And in Toronto's case specifically, was the use of buses to feed the subway lines, which is not unique. I mean, this is not a brilliant concept, but if you look at many cities, and Toronto has a nice grid system laid down, so it makes it easy for buses to operate. One bus goes north, one goes south. It's very easy to understand, but it does more so than a lot of other cities in terms of using surface transit to feed the subways. Now, the drawback, and people will tell you this in Toronto, is that means that they may be stuck on a bus for half an hour before they get to a metro, and people would rather be on a metro or LRT than a bus. But it does create this opportunity, and it also creates a grid that's already established. So what you're seeing over the last 20 years is a really going back into traditional neighborhoods and densifying, and those are all already next to either a subway or a very high-frequency bus route. So it means that more reliance, actually, ironically, will come in buses in Toronto as the people move. Again, if you're a 15 to 20 minute walk from a metro stop, that's not bad on a beautiful day. our evidence tells us that people are usually not much willing to walk much more than 500 or 800 kilometers, so say 10 minutes. And so they're going to be on a bus. So even though they're relatively close, like if you look on a map, you see the line, you say, oh, but actually they're going to rely on a bus to get them to that subway station. So it will mean that we need to do better jobs. And this is true. New York's going through this again, the other city I worked in, and trying to increase bus-only lanes, using technology for enforcement. Those sort of things are going to be critical to allow transit to support the density that's coming, because there's really no other alternative.
Yeah, I think both need each other. The transit need density and density need transit. So it's important, like a lot of cities need to rethink about the model they were using earlier, the suburban area. But I think in future, if we need to build more housing, we have to think about this vertical growth and then build transit around it. Like you mentioned about NEOM, that's what they are thinking.
But, you know, we probably do in many cases have to get smarter about how we do this. Now, there's great models like in Hong Kong where they've been able they own the land, they can do a combination. But in a lot of, with the cost of transit that just continues to go up for the construction of it, you know, we probably need to look to places like Spain, which have kind of figured out how to, and now every area, the geology, labor rates, it's sometimes very hard to do that. But I don't think you just dismiss that saying, well, okay, it's all different over there, because there are, you know, we may not always need that. We've done the most of our subway construction in the last 20 years in Toronto has basically been well over capacity. They're going to areas that are relatively low density. Now they will densify, but you know, we don't need to necessarily to run the same size trains all the time. Or design the system. I mean, once you have it, running a 5 or 6 car train is not really, there's not much difference. But in thinking about how we build the stations, and again, in Toronto, that was the discussion around light rail as an alternative. But there are many things between light rail and subway, all these different sort of in between and versions of that may need to be a little bit more. We need more tools in our tool chest in order to meet the demand at a reasonable cost to construct, but also to maintain.
Yeah, and you rightly mentioned we need more tool chest or more tools in our chest. So in fact, one of the emerging opportunities is autonomous vehicle. And I tried the autonomous vehicle in last 1 year in San Francisco, in Seoul, in Beijing, in Guangzhou. And I must say in some of the city, the technology is pretty impressive. It's quite developed. Like if you try Waymo in San Francisco, you never feel any difference. You feel like a human driver. And in Beijing, in Guangzhou, they are doing a commercial operation. So I think autonomous vehicle will be there sooner or later. I think next 10 year will be game changer. But a lot of cities are not ready. And a lot of cities are not yet thinking about it. And like you mentioned, we need to really think about the buses will be feeder to the rail and we need to provide. So how do you see urban mobility evolving in next decade, especially for this rise of autonomous vehicle and how cities should be ready for it?
Well, again, I think the basics will come. Again, whether, the first time I got on an autonomous bus, which was at a UITP event, you know, this was pretty cool and it moved. And it was, but, you know, the 50th time I get on that same bus, it's just the bus, right? Yeah. And so, I mean, at the end of the day, like the same things, I've got a meeting to get to, I've got my job, you know, again, it's kind of cool when you don't see a driver, but the basics will still be there. It will be a rubber tired vehicle, right? Moving along. Now, hopefully it's got a dedicated right of way. Maybe they're using some smaller vehicles in certain contexts. But you know, what we found in transit is most lines don't just have a standard pattern, right? They have a peak. Yeah. So you, even the smaller vehicles, like most agencies don't do that because if you need a bigger vehicle for 1 hour a day, well, you're not going to swap out the, you know, and maintain a fleet for that 1 hour. And the reality is once you're running it, and maybe if it's electric, it's even easier today. It's just, and especially if you take out labor costs, you know, whether it's 12 meters, 6 meters or 18 meters, the costs are not that hugely different after you've purchased the vehicle. And so I suspect some of those basics, you know, continue in terms of, again, and we've seen this with autonomous vehicles. If you don't put them in dedicated rights of way, I mean, maybe they're a little bit more efficient, but until you get this full like training or connected vehicles, all of them. And I think, again, I'm not an expert in this, but I feel like the idea that we're all going to have every car will be autonomous. I think we are decades out until we get to that stage. Not until we're using them. And I think actually, interestingly, you may see more things on light rail, right? Because there you have a dedicated right-of-way. So not totally exclusive, but it should theoretically be easier to run an automated vehicle in that context than it with predictable stops than it is with buses. But so I think those will happen. They will begin to come in. In fact, some of them, you know, it's level four autonomous. It's an interesting, or level, well, even level three, right? Because that gives your drivers automatic braking, some steering assists, like those things that are safety oriented that cars already have. It hasn't really fully transitioned into bus technology, which, you know, could be very useful in, for the same reasons. Maybe operations in a bus garage, so you don't need people to move the buses around because you're in a dead, like those things. So once you get to level three and level four, which is sort of like drone, and you talked about one where you've still got somebody there. I look, and again, my just from what I read, and I suspect we are a few decades away from a fully autonomous, absolutely autonomous fleet. But I think the where the really interesting things are, and probably the most increased percentage-wise for safety, is level three, right? Mm. And moving to these drone-type operations, especially for systems like BRT, right? Again, where you have dedicated right-of-way, I think those opportunities are huge. And I think what it means is if, because labor costs are 85 or 90%, maybe, you know, our biggest barrier to adding more service now, sometimes it's capital buying the buses, but often it's, of course, the operation. So if we're able to basically take the same number of staff and do more, it means we're able to drive even better service into these neighborhoods for essentially the same amount of money. So I think that that's the exciting part of where autonomous vehicles are going, is that it may allow us to sort of offer new services that were previously you know, just not economically feasible.
Yeah, especially like you mentioned, it can be more service in suburb area or where there is low density, and you can, once you purchase the vehicle, the operation cost doesn't make huge difference. So then you can run the service more frequently and more reliable. And I agree with you, you know, in some of the city, they are actually piloting doing this autonomous vehicle operation in the garage. In Europe, in Sweden, some of the cities are experimenting with this. And in fact, UITP is doing one project on EBRT. So idea is how to use autonomous vehicle for BRT operation, because you have a dedicated lane. So it's just like a rail system, like an automated rail system. If you have a dedicated lane, why can't you use autonomous technology there?
But, you know, I also suspect that when we talk about autonomous, but there are also all these other systems, like whether we are able to do better bus maintenance, right? Because we have not autonomous systems, automated systems that allow, like the buses, again, this has been true for 10 or 15 years, where you're able to sort of the plug and play, right? So before, if you had a problem with an air conditioning unit, send it over to be replaced. Well, now you pull out the air conditioning unit. Again, this is not that new anymore. You send the air conditioning unit for refurbishment, put in a new one, and the bus goes out. So whereas before you would have had a, like say before 15 years ago, you would have had a bus out, you know, for 3 or 4 hours minimum as someone fixed the AC unit. Now, you know, it's a, you know, 15 minutes in and out, the bus goes back to service, right? And somebody else goes and works on the AC unit. And that's true on the new, again, not that new, but things like that, and ability to actually use systems to do predictive failures, like how we can improve that, analyze tires, rail, all of those things. Again, they're coming, and they're all using, or increasingly using automated technology, right? The computers. And so you can do a lot of that, which should allow you to more efficiently deploy your maintenance resources, right? And do it safely. And that, again, because cost comes at the, you know, if you can keep a vehicle running longer, if it's in service more, so it spends less time in the garage, you maybe need a smaller fleet, right? Yeah. Which, and maybe you need less mechanics, but now you have more vehicles because you've got all these new autonomous vehicles, right? And so you've got more mechanics, but they're, because you've got, even if with efficiency, you've got all these new vehicles. So like a lot of that, and again, like we saw this with automated fare technology, you know, oh great, now we can remove all the people from the stations.
Well,
I mean, like some have, right? And it's
but
hard.
It's crazy, because sometimes you go to a station, you see nobody, and then you feel lost.
I feel lost. Maybe in certain cities, you feel less secure. You have questions. Yeah. And so a lot of these things, and this was, I remember the London Underground, you know, I don't think, my understanding is they didn't actually decrease staff at all without, but what they did, they changed them. So instead of the person making change for your ticket, you maybe need a different person, different training. They're out there keeping an eye on things, noting some problems, talking to passengers, right? So you've increased the quality of service.
Yeah, right.
It's cheaper in the sense to provide, and you've upped the, or, you know, or the same price maybe, and you've upped the quality of service. So I think like all of those innovations and all in these different areas all combine to really make the experience, you know, a lot more pleasant, easy to use, reliable. At least that's the hope. And that goes back to some of the earlier comments, you know, I've learned. You've got to have a motivated staff. You have to have people who really want to be there, who are excited about this. And in turn, you probably have to mean that as transformation goes, like you're working with your workforce, right? Because if people are worried, why would you push to bring in new technology if I'm just going to fire you, right? So, you know, you've got to think, but this is classic organizational theory. It has nothing, like, how do you lead this organization in a period of change, and which is fundamental, and the basics, you no matter what, whether it's autonomous, whatever, you still need good people who are working hard, who have a passion for delivering public service and public transit, and that's how your agency, because technology is not going to solve these problems for you. They'll help, but if you still, you're still going to have people somewhere in the organization, and they're going to still be either the strongest link or the weakest link, depending on how you do it.
I mean, I think that's a very powerful statement. Like, people are the, either can be your strongest or weakest link, because they make the difference, not the technology. You can have a best of fare collection system, best of buses, but if nobody's using it and nobody feel happy to use your service, it makes no service. And I think the public transport orientation need to be changed. And I was talking with the president of New York City Transit, and his LinkedIn line was that the customer service is my North Star. So you need to rethink public transit just as a vehicle company to customer service company and how to serve the customer. So that's very important, what you mentioned.
Yeah, no, and fundamentally, I think that's true around the world. I mean, slightly different practices in each city, people behave slightly differently, but more or less people are people, and you see the same patterns, you know, all around the world. It's just very minor differences.
And you studied history, so they remain the same for over the period of time, so they never change.
That's true.
No, that's amazing. No, now you mentioned briefly in the middle about your role at NEOM, and you were head of road division working on the policy. And I think one of the key thing we are seeing in the society, the mobility landscape is changing very fast. So I tell people, the 2007, the first time Uber launched, so the mobile phone Uber launch, it changed the on-demand landscape. In 2016-17, we see these e-scooters, and again, now the last mile connectivity change. And I'm hoping that by 2027, we'll see major push in autonomous vehicle and eVTOL and other kind of technology. So again, we will have a next decade of change. But the challenge is, you were lucky in NEOM, you started from a blank slate. You can put any policy, any infrastructure, any kind of processes. But a lot of cities, they have this legacy and challenge to change the policy. So want to understand, how do you see, if you're working in an old city, how you can overcome these policy? Like you mentioned, it's all about people, how they feel motivated to do something new. A lot of the city people, they are a little behind to understand how the technology landscape will change.
I think transformation is difficult in anything. And that's true for employees, and it's true for riders or just people living in the area, right? People get used to it, they're happy. I mean, unless there's a big problem, like where they're really missing something, generally it works. And so part of this change management is you've got to figure out how you can push things aggressively. So you want, while at the same time, because again, we talk about people being the greatest strength or the greatest weakness. If you get it wrong, you may have the great technology. I think Uber found this, and some of the micro transit, you know, they've been calibrating, and there's still a lot of controversy around that. But, you know, how they go into cities and how they adapted, and it worked for them in some areas, and in other cities it didn't, and sometimes they were shut out. And this is more true of the scooters. And so I think there's, you know, what I found on especially things like micro transit is it can be really granular in terms of how they adapt. So, you know, it's, you've got to figure out how it actually practically integrates well. It's not just throwing it in there. And so that's an example where fundamentally it comes back to the basic principles of engaging with people, working with them, change management, both for staff and riders. And that's a people thing, right? And people want to feel included and part of the journey. And so I think like a lot of these things where we've probably as an industry made mistakes at sometimes is around how you communicate, how you bring in this change. And because otherwise you do face a backlog or a pushback. And I think fundamentally the basics come down to, you know, cities are congested. They've got very little bit of space and you have to have that conversation about how you carve it up. And in some areas, you know, you are able to fully pedestrianize streets or fully transform them into public transit. But in most cities, and this isn't true just in, you know, an issue of Europe or Asia, like these are the same debates that go on all over the world. And they're the same, you know, we've got pedestrians, we've got micromobility, we've got public transit, right? We also have shipping. I mean, it's roads, but cars, like all of this stuff has to go. And in most cases, you're not free to just bulldoze a series, you know, to widen the road, even if you wanted to, which is, but so you're fundamentally, you've got all this technology, but you, if you need reserve lanes for bus, again, autonomous vehicles that are operating in mixed transit, basically, they're just more traffic. And in fact, they may increase traffic because people, you know, can watch a video instead of having to drive. So they might be willing to sit for 45 minutes. So they themselves are not going to solve those fundamental problems. You're still going to have this debate that has to be mediated where you come in, okay, we still need a bus lane, whether it's an autonomous vehicle or a bus. So like, how do we get that, right? And that does mean we probably are taking a lane away from traffic, like cars, and or from parking, or maybe wider sidewalks, right? I mean, you can have that debate too, right? Maybe we should have wider sidewalks. So all of that, and that's not a technology debate. That's how you, that's a community discussion about how you manage it to get that. And so, you know, in Toronto, traditionally we were, it was, pedestrians were first, you know, cycling and micromobility second, transit third, cars fourth. So, you know, I would often go into meetings and get reminded, you know, because my job was to push for public transit, but my, you know, being reminded that, well, cars are number fourth, the last, I'm number three, right? So how do you improve pedestrian? And of course, all transit users are pedestrians, so they're not in conflict, right? But, you know, those sort of things aren't mitigated by technology. Maybe we can model, we can do nicer, you know, images and give you a video walkthrough about how it will feel. That can be kind of cool. But the fundamental parts are still going to be this discussion about how you manage the people, how you do change. And again, I suspect if we come back and have this discussion in 2050, just about that, we will have, you know, there will still be vehicles that have, you know, four-ish wheels. They will be moving around. They will probably carry around 30 people or more, you know, depending on the size. And then there will be other vehicles that will operate in dedicated right-of-way. Maybe they're using maglev technology. My guess is that, you know, they'll still be using rail in most cases because generally, you know, you can still do high-speed rail. So, you know, you come back to this world, or if you took somebody from 1890, right, with the first electric streetcars having come in, you know, they'd probably be flabbergasted about a lot of things, but they'd still see the tracks on the street. They'd see a stop, and they'd probably know how to get on that new fancy vehicle that came. And they might be amazed at how it moves because it doesn't have a wire connected anywhere to a pantograph. But, like, you know, those sort of things. But I suspect fundamentally those basics will remain the same. And there will probably be new things. And, you know, eVTOLs might be part of it. But, you know, at NEOM, we expected that eVTOLs to do only 0.01, and that was with a massive adoption percent.
0.01. That's
of the mobile one, right? So an interesting one, and great for people in some cases, if depending on cost. But even in full scale deployment, with relatively unlimited budgets, you were still looking, you know, at
0.01
part of it. And so those traditional modes, even I suspect in 2050, when you have the odd eVTOL overhead, you've got, you're still going to end up with the basic fundamental modes that exist today.
And you rightly mentioned, you know, like pedestrian, cyclist, transit, and car, and the city need to prioritize. It's not about technology. It's about what city prioritize. And you, I think, mentioned a lot of cities are now stopping the cars on the street. Like Barcelona is a good example. They have these super blocks where they are giving back road to the pedestrian. And I think it's a lot of people don't understand that the walking is good for health. So it's not only about transit or traffic jam or congestion, but from personal health point of view, it's a good way to keep your body active and healthy.
Absolutely. And well, you know, and it's interesting, going back to Saudi Arabia for a minute, you know, one of the largest examples of having to move people, and I think it might be the largest, is the Hajj. Which occurs every year, and it's 4.5 million people. And traditionally, again, just very quickly, I think there were 30,000 buses required to move people, right? And the fact is, it's very challenging. The numbers are so high. People are doing basically the similar route, right? You follow a very prescribed route that's been the same for over 1400 years, right? But now they're trying to shift to a public transit model because it's a lot more efficient. But in some of the corridors, they've got to figure out how to move 70 to 90,000 people per hour per direction. And so in some of these cases, like, there's just no transit technology. So you go back to fundamental, well, what if we could make this walkable for people now? Are people who can't walk, and so there's all those things. But you know, you come back to some of the fundamental modes, and you know, cities have been defined by walking. Mostly, you know, Rome could only grow so big because they only really had walking, right? So you've always had this thing where people are willing to commute about a half an hour. And again, it's interesting. So half an hour by foot, half an hour by horse, half an hour by bus, half an hour by metro. And then you get these weird cases, more than half an hour, but like the super commuting in Europe or in Asia, where people can go 2.5 hours on high-speed trains. But if they only do that twice a week, I think if your math goes, it still comes back to on average half an hour each way for work. Yeah. Now they're going twice a week and they're traveling 900 kilometers. Mm-hmm. But it's all these, you know, so all this technology is, you know, high-speed rail, but you still come up to these interesting numbers that seem to always be no different from ancient Rome, in that people were more or less able to walk or travel half an hour by some mode. So it's interesting how all these fundamental things sort of come back to some things that, you know, don't really change, and culturally around the world are also very pretty similar.
Yeah, no, that's quite a good analogy to put. It's like fundamental need is to travel half an hour in different direction, different mode, and that's a way to live a life. Now, there's a lot of discussion going on about this AI and generative AI, and then AI will change a lot of industry. And I think there will be a lot of changes we see in public transit. Like some of the cities are already using AI for customer care experience, and there will be no barrier for language. You can chat, you can speak in any language. What are the other thing you see AI or generative AI or can help mobility space?
Well, so a transit agency or a transit company is at the heart of it, a large enterprise, depending on how big it is, right? And it has all those functions. So if you think about, you know, I always remembered at the TTC, you know, we always said we had almost one of everything, including at the time a blacksmith. And this wasn't that long ago because it was still efficient to hammer out. I think that has changed now. But, you know, you have all these HR functions. You have to buy billions of dollars worth of tires, rail, you know, and you have to manage your inventories and match them up, and you need to do all this analysis. And so I suspect, like, where you can see it's not even really focused on public transit, but if you can do procurement better, you know, and you're buying $1 billion worth of items a year, well, you know, a small savings, a 3% savings on that would be tens of millions of dollars, right? And then you come in, you have 14,000 employees, or now I guess 16,000 in the case of the TTC. How can you manage that, right? You have your large HR departments, just, you know, it's a function, a people function. Can that be cut down, right? And then you talked about the interactions with customers, right? How can you improve? So that may not even be a savings. I mean, you might be able to cut down a call center a little bit with AI, but you also improve the service quality because people can interact maybe 24/7. You have none of those issues. So you've got like a lot of those things. So I think like AI will help us probably do better maintenance, analyze things better. I think it will probably help us plan and predict and look for patterns, right, that we weren't able to see. It might allow us to improve bus service, you know, changing locations of stops. Again, we've done all those things traditionally, but you know, normally, like in the past, you take like a couple months and, you know, a service client, it would, you know, really think about a bus route and go out and talk. Well, now it might be, if we can look at the last 50 years of data and combine, you know, all this other data sets and throw it all together, well, you know, we might be able to look at those changes, you know, a lot easier to do and to make them, and that would make it more efficient or faster. And so I think things like that, and I think like there will be some customer focused things will allow us to do things, but I think at the fundamental it will allow public transit to be more efficient and more better aligned, especially on things that you can move around. You can't really easily move metro lines around, but you can do it with like buses and things like that. And so, you know, thinking about all those different questions, and I think agencies haven't yet fully grasped that. I mean, they're beginning to, but you know, AI is still not the idea of AI, but the current capacity of AI is still relatively new. And I certainly, you know, I've been thinking that I need to do more of this sort of research and figuring out like, what can you do with this? I mean, I have ideas and you hear things and talk about it, but at the heart of it though, it will go back to having employees like in service planning or in maintenance who are interested and excited and want to try new things. Like how can we do this, right? How can we use this? Again, it won't be for me to tell an engineer probably how to use AI or somebody specializing in track repairs, right? They've got to be passionate. You've got the right people there who will be like, wow, and you know, they can talk to people and they come up with new uses or figure those things out. And again, you have so many functions across accounting, right? You've got, I mean, it's huge, payable, like, you know, all of those things, I guess you'd ideally want to have passionate people who are in their little area figuring out how to do that. And then cumulatively, what you do is you ideally get a better, a more efficient system with better results, better maintenance, right? Better customer interaction, better bus routes, all of those different things.
No, I think that will be the biggest change, because I was talking to some other people. They say there will be no AI department in the company because every department need to have AI. So like you mentioned, accounting, procurement, maintenance, operation, planning, scheduling, customer care. So each function within the organization need to use some kind of AI function. And probably it will not reduce the manpower, but it speed up your action. Like you want to relocate the bus stops or you want to design the new stops, you can do much faster. And your procurement can be much faster. You don't need to wait for 3 month or 4 month cycle to evaluate and bid, and you can compare it very faster.
And I think, again, like I remember at the Toronto Transit Commission, like they used to have a program where they would, we'd pay for innovation. So if someone came up, and my favorite, very simple one was there's the exit signs, and somebody figured out, you know, you have to buy, it pays, cost something like $15 to buy a replacement piece of glass, but we have a glass shop. So we could produce that for like 25 cents. And, you know, one guy in a day could produce the next 5 years worth of these glasses for like 25 cents. And they split the savings with the employee. But that sort of, I mean, again, that's very analog, right? I mean, that was classic analog. But that innovation, like tempered with somebody. So maybe you have a few people who with the programming, but you want that person, that innovation, right? At the very simplest one, to figure out, you know, how to do things like that better, right? I mean, again, that one didn't, you know, fundamentally reshape transit, but that sort of passionate and say, hey, wait a minute, we can do this ourselves and a lot cheaper, right? Yeah. That's the sort of thing you kind of want. And I think you've got to get people thinking that way. So instead of using glass cutting today, right now we're going to talk about how we could maybe do a program, you know, and even if that person doesn't understand all the AI, asking the question. So then maybe you have the programmers and whatever that work with a person like that to come up with a new, you know, a new way of doing something. And again, it's probably going to be these little small things, right? On how we, and again, it might also be new materials, all of those 3D printing, right? There's all these things, but at the heart of it, you've got to have someone who really thinks about each little part of it and figures out how to use this new technology effectively.
Yeah, in fact, Metro North in New York, they are using a lot of 3D printing for parts because some of their train rolling stock is like 40-year-old and a lot of these manufacturers have stopped building, so they don't have those parts. And they cannot fabricate it outside because, I mean, you need 5 or 6 items or 10 items. So you are not going to fabricate and create something. So now they have a 3D printer in their workshop, and they need some part. They just print it there and use it. So you, like you said, it'll be become part of a day-to-day life, and use these technology tools to expedite and do your job faster.
And I assume it never stops, right? Because it just keeps going. And then you come, and when you do everything, if you ever got there, you would then go back to the beginning and go and see if you could even make that one more efficient or whatnot. So
why not do? No, great. Thank you so much, Adam. I mean, really enjoyed our conversation. Now, this is my last question. And it's basically about your personal journey. Like, you had such a remarkable journey from archaeology to mobility, and then TTC, SEPCO, NEOM, and now you're working with HDR. What are some of the key lessons you have learned from your career in transit and urban planning that could benefit the new generation, or people who are looking transit as a career, or people who are not looking transit as a career, why they should consider it?
So one thing that I've come to love about public transit is, especially when you're on the agency side, is that because it's part of every debate or every discussion, right? So, you know, you've obviously, it's part of climate change because transport's key, city building, livability, you know, safety, social mobility, and integrating communities, livability, all these things. So you really, while you have a very defined function, right, your job is within a public transit agency, you end up being sucked into all different discussions. And, you know, they, and even when a city's talking, like in Toronto and New York, they're one of the couple largest users of electricity. So now when we talk about changing the grid, I mean, just to produce one example, well, you've got to have the transit agency at the heart of it, because they're usually, after the water department, the largest user of electricity. So you get sucked into that discussion. So I think from my, like, you, everybody who will come into the industry, like, they're going to come in maybe as an accountant, right? In that, which isn't driving a bus, isn't planning a bus route, but has a part of it. And as they go up in an organization, they begin part of these bigger discussions, going back, how much is it going to cost to redo the grid? How is the transit? So you get part of all of those. And I guess, I mean, my only thing, if I was going to go back to it, and, you know, you could change something, is to think about, you know, so my degrees, I have an MBA, I have an undergrad, you know, I almost think I'd go back and do engineering or something, because that, I, when you get to a senior level, of course, you have to generalize across. And even if you're an engineer, you don't, you know, you've got accountants, lawyers, all those things. But I think part of it's a little bit more of a struggle in the industry if you don't walk in. And one reason I went back and did an MBA partly was to learn, fill in gaps, all those things. It was a good experience, but also it demonstrates you've got a core competencies. And so that would be one thing in terms of thinking about how people come into the industry. And again, it's changing, exciting. I you know, everyone talks about the new technologies, but as we've talked about in this discussions, it's still, there's going to be still fundamentals. Basically. And whether you're working from home 3 days a week or in the office, you're still going to be addressing a lot of these things. And I think it's an exciting place, and it's growing. There's way more transportation systems per capita in total around the world. So maybe even the opportunities are greater now than they would have been over the last, you know, several decades.
Yeah, no, I think what you said is very interesting, because that's how, which kept me in mobility and transit space, is like, when you work in this space, one day you will be talking to a mayor because the transit impact city. And second day, you'll be talking to a shopkeeper because the transit has impact on his shop or his shopping. And third day, you'll be talking to a passenger who is looking to get his bus home and back home. So you, and the next day, you will be talking to grid company or procurement or bus manufacturer. So it's a space where you don't just do one thing, but you learn about different facet of life and you different level of people. So I remember my meeting with some of the mayors, and then you feel so excited because you are talking to them and discussing about transit.
It's a fun place to be.
No, great. Thank you so much, Adam. I mean, really enjoyed our conversation. And generally, we end this podcast with this rapid fire question round. And idea is to learn a little bit more personal side of you. We now know about your experience in different part of the world, but we want to know a little bit more about you. So if you are ready, I'll start with my questions.
Okay, shoot.
Okay, so my question will be, if you were not in transit or consulting or archaeology space, what other profession you would have selected?
Oh boy, you kind of cheated, just about. You said I thought if I wasn't in transportation, I would be in archaeology. if you forced me, if I, you know, you blocked me from those two, I think what I probably have gone, maybe is gone back and got a degree in urban planning and probably stepped into that area. But no, if I wasn't in transportation, I would be in archaeology.
Archaeology, yeah. So that's a favorite space. Now you travel around the world. Which is your favorite city in the world and why?
So I think for me, it's I'm very much a Toronto kid. I've worked in probably 10 or 11 different countries and traveled to other ones. At home, I always find myself being very fundamentally, it's interesting. You can never, I think, escape where you grew up. The other place, and I think it's for the same reason, I've worked in Montreal. One of my favorite cities to be in is Montreal. It's not that from Toronto. And I think it is probably a product of the fact that when, you know, you came of age in university in Montreal, some of the first jobs, all of that stuff, it's still a place that I go back to. And I always was proud when people in Montreal thought I was from Montreal, because the non-Canadian listeners, you'll know that Montrealers kind of don't like Torontonians. And so being a kind of a classic born and bred Torontonian, I was always kind of proud to when they assumed that I was from Montreal. I guess you can feel the passion of the city, but I love being in cities. I'm sad about what's happening in Khartoum because it's a place I also have a soft spot in my heart, having spent a lot of time for. I'm a cities person, so I do enjoy cities all around the world.
Now Montreal is beautiful, I think, and like you mentioned, there is something going on between Toronto and Montreal people, but they still love each other, so Montreal is beautiful. Now my third question, which is your favorite book? I know you read a lot, so which is your favorite one?
So I have a series, it's by Elizabeth Peters, and I was trying and it's basically the 22nd plot summary is it's set around the turn of the 19th 20th century in the Middle East, and it's it's based on some historical figures, but it's fiction. And it's a family of archaeologists who are working. And she wrote a whole series of them. And one of them comes to mind, Seeing a Large Cat. But they're all based, and they're all murder mysteries. So they're archaeologists. It's kind of a nice, relaxing, you don't have to think too hard. But they're well-researched. And so they're fun to be into the region, which is a region, the Middle East, that I love, and do something that I like. And they're just fun stories.
Amazing. No, I'll put it in my reading list and read it. I love history. And now you said it's history plus fiction. And then,
They're perfect for a summer read.
Okay. So it's in my read list now. And a lot of other people will also do. So my next question will be, what one thing do you wish you should have learned early in life?
For me, I've seen myself evolve, and I've seen this formally and informally through like 360 reviews. Yeah. And, you know, I look at the leader I was back, say, 20 years ago, right, starting at the TDC, and sometimes you cringe. I was very lucky to have a bunch of people who reported to me nominally, but who were, you know, wise and had many years, and I guess, let's say, put up with some of my tendencies, but also, you know, I was able to learn. It was weird. I almost found them as a reverse a mentor, right? So you normally think of a mentor as somebody who's, further up or higher than you or something. These folks, you know, were higher in the sense that they had way more experience and had been around. A lot of them, I think, arguably took the time, and, you know, I'm sure they were frustrated at different. And I look back at 360 reviews, and you almost go, And you can see, but I've seen those. So, you know, the listening, the allowing people to lead. And, you know, when in NEOM, we built a whole department. And, you know, I think that the Adam of 20 years ago was much more of a micromanager, right? And whereas you learn that you've got to find good people, you've got to, and I think my 360s now, if I, you know, talking, because I've had them, would say that about me, right? Where you get good people, you give them support, you know, you back them up, and then you let them do their job. And then, of course, that multiplies your power or your influence, right? If you have this group, because no matter how hard you work, you're one person. So now if you've got a good team of six people, you know, in different areas, and they're all going out doing good things there, you've got them. I mean, that's what leadership is. And so, I would say, looking back, and I still, I see this, and, you know, just watching yourself and being really mindful of of like how you interact in those, because that's so, you know, you can be brilliant, you can be have work hard, all those things, but if you don't get the people part right, you're going to be facing, you're just going to come into barriers. And so I think that that's what I've really learned most.
So that's a very good learning. And in the beginning, actually, you mentioned the people who make the organization. So they take the organization forward and they take the organization backwards. So it's very important to find good people and give them space to do. No, that's a good learning. Thank you for sharing that. And it's important for me also to think that as a leader, how you help the team under you to grow. Now, this is my last question. And I always ask people this and get a very interesting answer. And I'm expecting something interesting from you. If you can change one thing in life, what would it be?
I think if I could change one thing in life, and I referenced this a little bit longer, I think I would have stayed maybe in school longer, because I don't regret some of my choices. I would have probably done something like engineering. And I think because I've seen the challenges that I've faced, and, you know, I'm over most of them now. But, you know, it was something that I think a lot of the world still revolves around. Obviously, education is important. You have to have the skills, but also falls back on, simple ways of evaluating. I look at you, I say, oh, well, you know, you've got this degree, you've done that experience. Like, you make those judgments about people. And of course, you can change people's opinion and things happen. But I found that so much. And the other thing, and I'm cheating because you said one thing, the other thing I would have done probably, and I've done a lot of travel, but, you know, as you go older, you've got family, you've got work, you know, you don't have that freedom to go be somewhere. And I've had a lot of experiences, so it's hard to complain. I think in retrospect, I would have done more. And those would be those combination. I kind of cheated on that one, though.
No, but that both are interesting option. And like you mentioned, travel is important. And I tell people, if you haven't traveled, you should travel, because travel make you humble. Now I travel a lot, and every travel make me humble, because I feel we are such a tiny part in this whole earth, and there are so many places, so many people, so many cities, so many things around the world. So we are just a tiny speck in this whole world.
And you learn a lot. And of course, I often travel either for work, but also just for fun. But you do, I mean, the more things you notice things, and as you're, you know, without having to go on a study tour or, you know, only think about on your vacation, like thing you do, the more you see, the more examples you have. And they just, you know, it really, I think, blends out that experience. And as you say, like, you're humbled, you see what you're doing well, but you also see where you could have the, you know, and the places around you. And so, yeah, and it's, and you meet more people, and that's,
and you meet more people,
and that's,
and people are same, like you mentioned in the beginning, people are same. They all have same thought process, same thinking. They look different, but internally, I feel everybody thinks same, whether you are in Asia, in Middle East, in Africa, in North America. It's very interesting. No, thank you so much, Adam. I think really enjoyed our conversation. A lot of great insight, a lot of great point you mentioned. I really wish you good luck for whatever you are doing in your new role. And looking forward to hear more exciting news from you in coming days.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the conversation. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. If you like this episode, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. If you have any feedback or suggestion for this podcast, please feel free to reach out to us at info@mobility-innovator.com. I look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you.